From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! We review President Clinton's just concluded trip to South America, where he visited Venezuela, Argentina, and Brazil, and then a look at a global citizen's guide to culture, emphasizing the achievement of the non-Western world, what every American needs to know as we enter the next century. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Argentine President Carlos Menem endorsed President Clinton's call for including developing countries and international efforts to limit greenhouse gas emissions, blamed for global warming, while agreeing to the concept, neither side has said what those limits should be. President Clinton was unable to win such a pledge from Venezuela or Brazil, the other countries he visited in a week-long South American trip. Clinton returned from Argentina, the last stop on his Latin America tour, as the campaign investigations continue to simmer. Indiana Republican Congressmember Dan Burton, who heads an inquiry by a House panel, charged that some recently released tapes of Clinton fundraising events appear to be doctored and that lip readers may be hired to decipher inaudible comments. Despite its denials, the government of China decided as early as 1995 to try to buy political influence in the U.S. by contributing to congressional campaigns, this according to the Los Angeles Times. The newspaper says the FBI uncovered the plan through intercepted communications between the Chinese embassy in Washington and Beijing. At least $2 million was earmarked for the effort to counter what was perceived as Taiwan's disproportionate influence on the U.S. Again, that according to the Los Angeles Times. The founder of Hamas says attacks against Israel have been suspended, but would resume if punitive measures against Palestinians are used. Meanwhile, a special U.S. envoy pressed to renew progress in peace talks, Israel agreed to extradite a U.S. teenager wanted for murder in Maryland. Congo Republic's ousted president has left his southern stronghold after his forces were routed by former military ruler Denis Sassou Nguesso. Pascal Assouba was believed to have fled to a UNITA-held area of Angola. The turmoil has implications for oil companies in the region. China plans to sign contracts with U.S. firms, including BOA, this according to the official Xinhua news agency. Beijing is striving to set a friendly tone for President Jiang's October 29th summit with President Clinton in Washington. On Saturday, it pledged to halt sales of anti-ship missiles to Iran. A top Iraqi oil official says Baghdad is close to awarding oil concessions to Elf Aquitaine and Total, both of France. If deals go through, they would be the first Western firms to sign exploration accords with Iraq since Gulf War sanctions were imposed. A possible midweek strike by Amtrak workers was sidestepped yesterday when labor and management agreed to a Transportation Department request to extend contract talks for at least a week. A strike at midnight Tuesday would have affected 50,000 daily Amtrak riders and 450,000 commuters who use trains in the Northeast that run on Amtrak tracks. Affected lines would have included the Long Island Railroad and the New Jersey Transit, Philadelphia area trains, as well as others. With the two sides still well apart on key wage issues, Amtrak spokesperson said the extra week will permit Amtrak more time to work out contingency plans to possibly operate commuter trains in the event of a strike at a later date. Amtrak and the union, which represents 2,300 workers who construct and maintain railroad track, have been in talks over a new contract since the old one expired at the end of 1994. President Clinton intervened in August to block a threatened strike, imposing a 60-day cooling-off period and appointing a three-member board to help resolve the dispute. The nation's health authorities are increasingly concerned about a poultry contaminant that can be as debilitating, if not as deadly, as salmonella. According to the New York Times today, researchers say that the contaminant, the Campylobacter bacterium, infects a larger percentage of chickens than they had realized, and that antibiotics used to treat people sickened by infected poultry appear to be losing their effectiveness. Campylobacter, which is the leading bacterial cause of foodborne illness in the country, has also been linked to a rare but serious paralytic disease. 6 years ago, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that Campylobacter infected 30% to 70% of all chickens. Today, using better detection methods, researchers say it infects 70 to 90%. Scientists now believe that Campylobacter can cause disease as severe as Salmonella, although fewer people die. Campylobacter is responsible for 2 to 8 million cases of campylobacteriosis a year and 200 to 800 deaths. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. There were a number of critical conferences in New York City this past weekend. Later in the week, we'll bring you excerpts from the Yari Yari Conference, the first major gathering of women writers of the African diaspora. And tomorrow, we'll be reporting on the Media and Democracy Congress, where grassroots media activists came together from around the country to examine ways of confronting the domination of the corporate media. And speaking of corporate media, later in today's show, we'll be taking a look at the press coverage as well as some of the substantive issues behind President Clinton's first-ever official trip this past week to Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. But first, there was also an important gathering this weekend at the New School for Social Research in Manhattan, examining the work of Alain Locke, the first major African-American philosopher and a major intellectual force behind the Harlem Renaissance. We're now pleased to be joined by Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah, a professor of philosophy and of Afro-American studies at Harvard University. He's author of In My Father's House and co-author of a new book with Henry Louis Gates, of a book called The Dictionary of Global Culture. Professor Appiah, can you tell us why you were here in New York this past weekend?
We've been having a conference at the New School in celebration and study and response to the work of Alain Locke, who was an important African-American philosopher, or perhaps the most important African-American philosopher that there's been so far, who was very important, most famously, as the intellectual godfather of the Harlem Renaissance. He was the sort of theorist of the aesthetic side of the Harlem Renaissance, and he was the person who really did most to bring an appreciation of African and African-American art to a broader audience in that period. But he was also a philosopher, and he was trained at Harvard. He was the first African-American Rhodes Scholar, so he was trained at Oxford as well. He finished Oxford, went to the University of Berlin, and went back to Harvard, got a PhD in philosophy, and then ran the philosophy department at Howard University for most of his life, for 40 years. And extraordinary man in correspondence with people all over the world. One of the great things about Howard, really before the integration of so-called elite education in the late 60s in this country, the Howard, which was the sort of top black university, was in some ways the most cosmopolitan university in the country, and it had people from all around the world. And at this conference, one of the attendees was a woman who was for many years the librarian in charge of the Alain Locke collection at Howard, and she's somebody who was born in India. She's an Indian-American. So, and we were talking about his philosophical work. He was one of the people who really theorized cultural pluralism, along with Horace Kallen, who's another Harvard and Rhodes Scholar.
What do you mean by cultural pluralism?
Well, that was one of the things we were talking about. I mean, basically, it's the idea that each group in the society, each ethnic group, each racial identity, brings a distinctive cultural contribution, and that it's part of the condition for the flourishing of a deep democracy that you shouldn't try and force everybody into a single cultural mode, that it's not far from it's being necessary for democracy for everybody to share a single national culture, which was a sort of model that is propagated, say, by the French model of French civilization as the core of French political culture. In a real democracy, which is multiracial and multi-ethnic, people will have equal citizenship and they will participate equally as citizens, but they'll also live within different and develop different cultural traditions, different cultural understandings. Though it's a very important point about Locke that he wasn't arguing that these should be closed off to each other. His view was that the development of these many different traditions and their interpenetration, their communication with each other, was what was desirable.
When you say he was one of the great intellectual forces of the Harlem Renaissance, explain this period in U.S. history.
Oh. Well, we're talking about the period really after the First World War, when there was really an extraordinary cultural flourishing in the African-American world. It's called the Harlem Renaissance. That's a bit misleading because there were important components of this flourishing that occurred in D.C. and in Chicago and in a number of other places. So I think one can overrate the centrality of Harlem itself. But at that time, Harlem was, as it were, the capital of the black world. In some ways, I suppose it still is. And writers like Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and so on, poets and novelists and intellectuals and painters and musicians, of course, were all together in this rich brew of creativity. And I think Locke really thought that that this development of what you might call high culture, music and literature and the plastic arts, painting and sculpture, I think he saw it strategically as part of the business of combating racist stereotypes of black people. So that for him, it wasn't only that he valued this art in its own right, he was deeply committed to it on aesthetic grounds, but that he saw it as part of his politics to show African Americans that to lead African Americans in an appreciation of what other African Americans could do, and also to speak to a wider world about the intellectual and cultural achievements of African Americans and to contribute to that. And this was enormously influential not only in the United States, but in the development of the thinking of the cultural leaders of the anti-colonial struggles in the Caribbean and eventually in Africa. And people like Léopold Sédar Senghor, who was a great French poet born in Senegal and eventually became president of Senegal at independence, people like him were very much influenced by the ideas of the Harlem Renaissance a little bit later in the 30s when they developed the so-called philosophy of negritude, which was this black cultural movement that flourished throughout the Atlantic world, both in the Caribbean and to some extent in black London and black Paris, and mostly in black Paris, and then eventually in West Africa.
And who did Alain Locke influence in the struggles against colonialism in the Caribbean?
Well, I think it's not so much Locke. I don't know that Locke himself particularly did, but the Renaissance was very important in the thinking of the greatest of the Caribbean theorists of negritude was Aimé Césaire from Martinique, who's still alive, and who, as is Senghor, who was for years a deputy in the French Assembly from Martinique and a member of the French Communist Party and the mayor of one of the towns, the capital of Martinique.
We're talking to Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah, and he is the co-editor of a new book called The Dictionary of Global Culture. Now, Alain Locke is one of the entries, one of the thousands of entries in this book. But why don't you tell us about how you conceived of this really quite amazing cross-cultural dictionary?
I don't remember exactly how it started. The earliest thing I remember is that my colleague Skip Gates and I, and we've been colleagues for a very long time. We first met in the early 70s when we were both students at Cambridge University in England, and we've taught together since the early 80s at different universities. I think we were at Cornell in the late 80s, and we were talking to a Chinese colleague of ours who teaches African-American literature in Beijing. And the topic came up of our cultural ignorance about Chinese culture. I mean, here is someone who's in China teaching about African-American culture, which is great. But you know, we need to be, there needs to be some traffic back. And so we said, I don't know how it came up this way, but we said to her, well, what are the 10 things that you think, you know, if you just were allowed to give people 10 things that they really should know in order to have an appreciation of what's important about China? And she gave us a list. And there were some things on it that we had ideas about or had heard of. I mean, even in those days, one had heard of Tiananmen Square. This was before Tiananmen Square became notorious for a different reason. But there were things on it, like the Spring Festival, I think, was one of them, which I'd never heard of, as a, that maybe just decided my ignorance, but anyway. And it occurred to us that it would be an interesting idea to talk to people who were from different places in the world or who studied the culture of different regions of the world and ask them the same question and just look at the lists that were produced. This was at a time when there was a fair amount of talk about cultural literacy after the work of Edie Hirsch. And
who is Edie Hirsch?
Well, he's a professor, I forget exactly where he teaches, I think maybe at the University of Virginia, who tried to identify the key core elements of American culture that every so-called educated American should know. And this includes, you know, stuff about baseball and stuff about literature and stuff about the Constitution. It's a sort of hodgepodge of very interesting material. And his idea was that there was a sort of analogy between literal literacy, being able to read and write, and having the basic vocabulary of American culture. Well, many people felt, I don't think this was entirely fair criticism myself, but many people felt that this was a very Eurocentric list that he produced. I think if your aim is to characterize the core of American culture, you can't help but be Eurocentric because American culture is Eurocentric and the dominant culture is Eurocentric, and we're trying to open it up, but if you're trying to describe it, you'd have to begin by saying that it's very much more focused on Europe than anywhere else. But in fact, he had done a great deal to make sure that in his cultural literacy list there was significant amount of African-American material and so on, and Hirsch certainly thinks that you can't understand, for example, American musical culture, you can't make sense of any of it if you don't understand the central role of African-Americans in it. So I don't think it's myself fair to characterize him as it were anti-multicultural. But anyway, but what was true about it, I think, was that this was sort of focused on a national understanding of literacy, and our thought was, well, we are citizens of nations, and I'm not an American citizen, though I'm on the way there. And if the INS is listening, I wish you would hurry up. But
where are you a citizen of?
I'm a British citizen. I was born in London when my father was a student there. Though my father's Ghanaian and I grew up in Ghana. But we're also citizens of the world in a certain way. We're increasingly citizens of the world. And that means we have responsibilities as to other people around the planet, not just to fellow nationals, and also responsibilities to the planet, but also responsibilities, I think, to understand each other, because we're sharing the world, and in order to share the world without strife, we have to know things about each other. So it seemed attractive to have a notion of a global culture that wasn't the literacy notion, the notion of what everybody educated already knew, but was rather a notion of what it would be nice if everybody learned here as a part of their relationship to everybody else in the planet and their cultures. Now, so in order to do that, we had to obviously include a lot of Western culture, because that's a central part of you know, what's important globally. On the other hand, we couldn't, if we were going to do this job, include everything that you would include in a similar sized book that was just about Western culture. So some stuff in Western culture that, you know, some people think is very important, I probably think it's important too, we didn't put in. But Shakespeare is in there next to Shaka Zulu, the Zulu king, who really created the modern Zulu nation. And I think that that's part of the pleasure of the book. It's alphabetical. And so side by side, you have Shakespeare, who's one kind of important human producer of human culture, and Shaka, who's another, who's very important to Zulu self-understanding and very important in the shaping of really the world of Southern Africa as it now is. But Alain Locke gets to be next to John Locke, the great 17th century British theorist whose ideas about rights are so central to the shaping of the American Revolution. So that was sort of how it started, and it was then it took a, you know, we spent a very long time after that working with graduate students mostly to make these lists, to decide which things on those lists in the end we would actually include. And in the end, of course, there's much more than 10 things about China. And to go out to the libraries and see what we could find about the ones that we didn't know about.
We're talking to Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah, professor at Harvard University and co-editor of a new book called The Dictionary of Global Culture. We'll be back with him and these terms of global culture in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue our conversation with Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah. He is a professor of Afro-American Studies at Harvard University, author of the book In My Father's House, and now co-editor with Henry Louis Gates of a new book called The Dictionary of Global Culture. Well, you said you started off by talking to this person who teaches African-American studies in China about maybe the 10 most important issues, ideas, events, people that we should know about in China. And one of the things they mentioned was the Spring Festival. What is the Spring Festival?
Well, let me tell you what we say about it in the book, or some of what we say about it. Chinese Festival. The Spring Festival, or Chinese New Year, starts on the eve of the Lunar New Year and goes on until the third day of the New Year. An ancient festive occasion dating back to antiquity, it's been observed with long-established rituals throughout the country, though since the establishment of the People's Republic, many of the old customs have been reformed to fit the new ideology. And then, you know, we talk about the offerings to the ancestors and incense and the celebration of the kitchen gods and so on. And that's something, you know, it's a very important thing. It's sort of like, not knowing about that would be not like not having a sense of the importance of Christmas in Sweden or of Yom Kippur in Israel. And it's, you know, this is interesting because in theory the gods are no longer officially recognized, obviously, by the state and so on, but still the celebration goes on, and it goes on in Chinese communities, not just in China, but throughout the Chinese diaspora. So it's celebrated in New York and San Francisco and in many cities in Latin America and in the Caribbean as well.
And then there's the Silk Road.
Yes, there's the Silk Road, which is sort of a long tradition of connection between the Orient, between China and eventually Western Europe. And that represents one of an important category of things in the dictionary, which is in the book, which is that one of the problems with thinking in terms of cultural pluralism is that you tend to think of each culture as a kind of separate thing. Whereas over long periods of historical time, cultural exchanges have been going on between all these different areas that we think of as separate from each other. You know, let me give you a couple of examples. I'm a philosopher by training. We wouldn't have the texts of Plato and Aristotle if the Arab scholars, philosophers, theologians hadn't preserved them during the so-called European Dark Ages. We recovered the heart of the Western tradition from Islam in the early modern period, in the Renaissance and the late medieval period. And so the thing that we think of as the heart of Western civilization, as it's been understood recently, this sort of classical heritage, was transmitted in part by going in a route that took you out of the West into what is now Turkey and Persia and Egypt, and back again when this learning was rediscovered later. And there are so many stories like that. Monteverdi, you couldn't think of a more classical, in the sense that we use the word now, classical music composer. But it's been argued by musicologists recently that Monteverdi's, the dance pattern of the shakan in Monteverdi comes either from Andean music or possibly from Arab music. It's not, I think there are disputes about that. So here again, something bang in the middle of the West comes from, has this important contribution from outside. And if I can just give an example in the other direction, I grew up in Ghana, and my hometown is Kumasi, the capital of Ashanti, and that's about not many miles from Bonwiri, which is the town where kente cloth was invented. Now, kente cloth, the tradition of weaving, is part of a widespread West African tradition of weaving. But the silk from which the most valuable kente cloth was made was imported by people in Ashanti from, it eventually came from India and so on, because they wanted, what they wanted was to make wonderful cloth from the best stuff they could find, and the best stuff they could find came from somewhere else. Our beads, we have wonderful bead tradition, glass beads which are made from crushed glass, which is then re-sintered to make beads, large beads. They can be more than a centimeter in diameter. The glass that they were made from came from Venice, in plain colored beads, and it was traded all the way down through the Sahara into West Africa, and then these ground up and remade into the wonderful West African beads. So, the coinage in Carthage at the time of, you know, Dido, Queen Dido, who is talked about in Virgil's Aeneid, turns out to have some gold in it that must have been mined in West Africa. So there was trade back and forth. So I think, you know, one thing that's wrong with the picture of the cultural world that we have is that we have this picture of all these separate compartments, whereas there's always been a porosity at the edge of the compartments. And even, in fact, I've always felt that if you think about the cities that are the great centers of civilization, New York now, London in the 19th century, Venice in the heyday, in the early modern period, in the 15th, 16th centuries, Athens in the 5th century BC. What do all these great places have in common? Alexandria. They're crossroads. They're places where people, sailors, are coming and bringing stuff from all over the place. They're at the end of the Silk Road. They're at the heart of the trade system of the British Empire. They're in the complex web of exchanges that the Athenians were engaged in with the Phoenicians and the Egyptians and the Persians and the Scythians to the north. The ancestors of the sort of modern northern Europeans. So, one of the things that I think you learn is that so much of what we think of as sort of belonging over there has elements in it that come from over here, and so much that we think of as belonging over here turns out to depend essentially on elements that come from somewhere else.
You're listening to Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah, who is a professor of philosophy and Afro-American studies at Harvard University, who, along with Henry Louis Gates, also a professor there, has written the dictionary, or I should say edited the dictionary, of global culture. I thought it was interesting this past week, as President Clinton made his way around Latin America, how little we learned even during the trip, let alone before, how much we know about other cultures. So I was looking through the book and looking for great Latin American poets and writers. Among the people I saw in your book was Violeta Parra, and also her brother, and they are Chilean.
These are not people that are normally, I think, taught or talked about in schools and so on. And I think, you know, our lives would be enriched by knowing a bit about them. I mean, Violeta Parra is a singer, but also, importantly, someone who collected traditions, folkloric traditions of Chilean music. And again, that's something that you find over and over again around the world, that in moments of sort of national self-definition, people draw on what we now call folk culture, the culture of ordinary people, often peasants, to help define their sense of what's distinctive about them. And you don't have to be, Violeta Parra is a great example, but Walter Scott did this. So Walter Scott, Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border, was all about collecting Scottish folk music in order to maintain a cultural identity for Scotland, which at that point was being mightily absorbed by England. And as you know, the Scots have recently voted to separate themselves off a little bit more again. But in these moments when people feel their identity challenged, one of the things they draw on, I think, is folk culture. And so she was, and you know, and I think it's fair to say that anybody in Chile would have a hard time living their life without knowing anything about her.
And so many of the people that are in your Dictionary of Global Terms, Dictionary of Global Culture, are in some sense revolutionary. I mean, are in some sense fighting repression. Mm-hmm. You have Violeta Parra, who used her music against the regime there.
Yes, yes. And that's part of a reflection of the ways in which what we call culture, which is a term that I don't want to be asked to define, but which includes everything from sort of everyday practices through to you know, what we call the highest of high culture, the you know, famous paintings and famous works of music of one kind and another, jazz classics, that kind of thing. Is an enormous resource for, it can be and has been an enormous resource, I think, especially in the last few centuries of enormous growth of state power, enormous resource for building solidarity and expressing and sustaining resistance.
Professor Pia, who are some of the people you chose as the leaders and the most important people to know to understand Africa, for example, from your home country, from Ghana?
You know, I didn't think about it like that very much. I actually, from Ghana, one of the most important things is not a person, but it's a tradition, and it's a tradition that was carried on by many people, and it was a tradition of, it's really one of our most important art traditions, and it's the tradition of the gold weights. They're not made of gold. They're used for weighing gold. They're made of brass. And I'm trying to remember whether we listed them under Asante, where they come from. Yes, we did. Used by the Asante in Ghana to weigh and measure gold dust, created by a process known as lost wax, more commonly known by the French term cire perdu. The weight is molded in wax and encased in clay or earth. After the encasement dries, a hole or several holes are drilled into the top, forming canals through which the melted metal is poured. Now, that's the technique, and we go on to talk about the way in which these weights are often animals, symbolize stories which have proverbial tags that everybody knows.
You've been listening to Harvard University Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah. He's Professor of Philosophy and Afro-American Studies. Along with Professor Henry Louis Gates, also of Harvard, he co-edited the book The Dictionary of Global Culture. Coming up next, we take a look at President Clinton's just concluded trip through South America. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Professor James Petras. He is a professor of Latin American history at the State University of New York at Binghamton and has actually just returned from Argentina. That's relevant to us today because we want to take a look at President Clinton's trip that he just wrapped up, where he went to Argentina, Venezuela, and Brazil. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Petras.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Amy. It's a pleasure to participate in your program.
Well, why don't we start off with the country you were just in? You were there to honor Che Guevara, the Latin American revolutionary. President Clinton was also there this week, in fact, encountered quite a bit of protest. Can you talk about what happened to him?
Well, I think basically Clinton is walking into a situation in which President Menem is fast. His image and his policies of provoked a tremendous protest just in the last year. There have been a couple of general strikes in the face of record high unemployment rates of between 17 and 18%. Living standards have been falling, and the hopes that people had, the faith that this free market formula, the pain would lead to prosperity, is wearing thin. I think that's one part of it, especially as it affects working people. The other part is the blatant corruption and thuggery that characterizes Menem's regime. There's been 850 attacks on the press since he came to power, 120 this year, including the murder of a photographer right in the vicinity of one of his businessmen friends.
And he came to power when, Menem?
He came to power in 1989 at the height of the hyperinflation, and one of his achievements has been the reduction of inflation to single digits. But that's not enough. Stability was supposed to bring prosperity, and that's not the case. There's been also a tremendous amount of windfall profits. I was just reading a journal while I was down there. George Soros has come in the last year or so and bought up over 500,000 acres of choice farmland, four of the six main shopping centers in and around Buenos Aires. And he's kind of a prototype of the kinds of rentier speculative earnings that are characteristic of the kind of capitalism that Menem has fostered. So on the one hand, you have these multi-billionaires reaping the windfall profits from this deregulated market. And on the other hand, you have a welfare state that's being shredded to pieces, and many, many people are falling through the cracks. And on top of that, whenever there's an independent body like the judiciary that ruled against some of Menem's decrees, he simply appoints new judges on the Supreme Court, changes the balance in his favor by politicizing the judiciary. His police and intelligence agencies are intimately tied to the past military regimes, and some of the most blatant issues, like the terror bombing of the Jewish community center that killed over 80 people and maimed hundreds, remained unsolved. The attacks on human rights organizations like the Plaza de Madres, the Plaza de Mayo, who I spoke with, they were attacked twice in 1 month.
And this is the group of mothers and wives who have members of their family who've been killed during Argentina's dirty war of the 80s?
That's right. And when I asked the leader, Abe Bonafina, she says to me, how can the police solve these crimes when they are the perpetrators? So there's this sense, deep sense, among Jewish intellectuals, among human rights people, and among the middle class in general, that Menem's regime is just rife with gangsters. And it's this issue that Clinton failed to raise during his visit.
James Petras is professor of Latin American studies at the State University of New York at Binghamton. We'll be back with him to talk about President Clinton's trip through Latin America in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with James Petras, who is professor of Latin American Studies at Binghamton University. That's the State University of New York at Binghamton. Now, apparently, President Clinton was forced to answer questions when he suggested to Argentina's President Carlos Menem that the Organization of American States create a special unit to ensure press freedom. In an interview with Argentine journalists, Clinton was asked about his views on freedom of the press and numerous threats, the ones you've been mentioning, Professor Petras, that have been made against reporters and photographers. He said Argentina is building a civil society and it has to be built brick by brick. And the fact the press is free is a good thing. The fact that some people feel free to at least threaten and perhaps harm members of the press is a bad thing.
Yeah, I think this is the usual Clinton flip-flop, paying lip service to the principle and then violating it in practice. The embrace that he gave Menem, not the cold handshake and the distance, is what counts. Menem is involved in a life-and-death election that's coming up next week. As I said, his government has been very much deteriorated. And this appearance of Clinton with Menem is a way of bolstering a very faltering regime. And I think the very fact that Clinton put him on the itinerary, spent a lot of time with him, failed to raise the fundamental issues of anti-Semitism and repression, failed to refer to the basic social issue is what provoked a lot of this outburst. It was not only aimed at Menem, but this very public embrace of Menem by Clinton that has stirred the ire. I didn't find anyone, even among the centrist, center-left politicians, that was pleased with the fact that Clinton is making this appearance at this time and giving the green light to Menem's policies.
Can you explain what this anti-Semitism is about in Argentina?
Well, it has deep roots. There were a lot of Nazis that fled to Argentina. Perón, despite his welfare and labor policies, was an aficionado of fascists, and he spent a lot of time in Franco's Spain in his exile. He was a good friend of Stroessner. Subsequently, right-wing politicians and terrorist groups grew and were quite formidable in the intelligence agencies and the military. I remember at the beginning of the military dictatorship in 1976 when several friends of mine who were Jewish intellectuals were arrested. As they were being tortured and beaten, they were accused of being Jewish communists, and it was very clear that there was deep anti-Semitism in the security forces. Later, when this became public, the military didn't want to open this front to criticism, and so they toned it down. But these people stayed in. Subsequently, when the elections took place, very few of these people were purged. There was no denazification campaign, and subsequently under Menem, the few military officials who were brought to trial were freed through an amnesty, and Menem has staunchly defended his intelligence agencies. He's strengthened their position in society, and despite these terrorist attacks, he's not investigated why the police have come up with no investigation that has pinpointed the source of this terrorism.
I wanted to get back to what happened in Buenos Aires this week, the protests. First, there were a large number of protests of thousands of people that marched toward the state dinner that Menem was hosting for the Clintons on Thursday, and then a group of about 50 masked youth who smashed the windows of foreign banks and threw Molotov cocktails. Can you tell us about who these people are and what it is they're protesting? The only thing I saw on television was an American flag burning. I heard about excrement being thrown at President Clinton's car.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between the oppositionist trade union, the human rights group, the neighborhood organizations, and a group called Quebracho, which is a very peculiar group. Many people on the left are very skeptical about its origins and whether it's infiltrated by the intelligence agencies. Others refer to it as an ultra-leftist group that has no ties to the popular movements. I think we have to be careful because in the past, in Argentina, there have been small stores broken and cars attacked to discredit major popular demonstrations that repudiate the economic policies of the Menem regime. So a word of caution here, the more extreme activities that you mentioned were not part of the principal demonstration which mobilized tens of thousands, if not more, people. And I think the main thrust was not to break a window or attack overturned cars. They were to put before the world public the fact that the majority of Argentine people are fed up with the free markets. And while they may benefit speculators like George Soros and other major Bank of Boston who are reaping record profits, it's not doing any good for the working people in the middle class of Argentina. And I think that's the big news item. And we should not be derailed by the actions of a couple dozen people of questionable political credentials.
Well, let's talk about this fast-track authority that President Clinton is seeking from Congress that would allow him to push through world trade agreements or regional trade agreements like with Latin America, and what it means for the people of, say, the three countries he visited, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela.
Argentina is one case of where you've had a tremendous shift in the labor force from a predominantly manufacturing labor force of close to 40%, one of the most industrialized countries. It's down close to 20%. Many of these former manufacturing workers are now in the informal sector. They're engaged in low-paid service work. Some of them took their indemnification, their payoffs, invested it in taxis and kiosks, many of which went bankrupt. That's on one side. On the other side, the financial services, some of the retail houses, plazas, etc., have done quite well. So you get a majority of the Argentine population that has suffered. Pensioners have saw their incomes decline precipitously. Manhattan prices, living on $200 a month pension. School teachers who I spent time with have been on a hunger strike for the past 6 months. Their salaries run from anywhere from $400 to $500 a month, again, with Manhattan prices in Buenos Aires. Many of the public sector workers haven't been paid in months. They usually have been operating on the basis of family support or credit from small businessmen. There's been over 30,000 bankruptcies of small and medium-sized businesses in Argentina, while a whole network of lawyers, public relations people, financial advisors, professionals in law, medicine, that have opened their private clinics have been part of this bonanza. So you have 20% benefiting, 60% hit very badly, and 20% holding their own. That's the picture in Argentina. I think it applies in greater or lesser degree to Brazil and Venezuela. The people on the fast track inside with access to export industries, employees of multinationals, people in the financial sector, import sector, they're doing quite well. The rest of the people in traditional manufacturing industries for the local market, small-scale businessmen, they're doing very badly. School teachers, public health workers, a great majority of whom are women, are also been hit very badly. There's been a radicalization of female workers in a recent period that's very striking. In Brazil, I think the movement to open up Brazilian economy has met resistance in Sao Paulo, and the push toward agro-exports has provoked a tremendous movement among the landless rural workers who've been taking on the Cardoso government. It's interesting that Clinton did not talk about land reform, in contrast to the Pope, who was there a couple weeks early in Rio and made the issue of savage capitalism and land inequality an issue. So that puts Clinton to the right of the Vatican on social issues in the major country of Latin America. The same goes in Venezuela. It's a bonanza for the oil companies. They're deregulating, privatizing. I look at the Business Journal, and they're euphoric about the opportunities of making huge fortunes. 65% of the labor force in Venezuela now is in the informal sector. Venezuela had one of the highest per capita incomes in Latin America in the mid-70s when I was doing my research there. Today, it's a crime-infested country where great fortunes are being made, and a largely wounded middle class is looking for a way out of the country.
I wanted to end with a picture that was presented, interestingly enough, in the New York Times this past Wednesday. This was the story of President Clinton in Brazil, a meeting with President Cardoso. He was there 3 years after Clinton won agreement from Latin American leaders for a hemispheric free trade zone by the year 2005. And he made a trip to the Villa Olímpica neighborhood sports complex to connect with the poor. It was a very poor area. And they described the scene in the days leading up to his appearance, saying it bordered on the surreal and that local people were outraged by American demands. According to officials at the sports complex and to local press reports, the demands included the installation of a 10-foot-tall bulletproof glass wall to protect the president from surrounding neighborhoods, authorization to bring in heavy weaponry, a request that the complex be closed to neighborhood youngsters for 2 days before the visit, and another that train service be stopped for more than 4 hours on Wednesday. But perhaps the most unexpected request was that Brazil's 160 million citizens suspend daylight savings time during the president's visit to allow him another hour to prepare for his evening schedule. Also, the request that most worried residents was that the police occupy five favelas or impoverished neighborhoods surrounding Villa Olímpica, some as far as 1.5 miles away. Pretty incredible picture of President Clinton meeting with the poor.
Right. I think it's also an expression of the arrogance of empire. I mean, this is the viceroy coming and dictating the most detailed terms of submission, subordination, and servility. And it's interesting that it should take place in Brazil, which has a tradition of nationalism. It has a tradition of self-assertion going back from the 30s. And under this former Marxist sociologist, Cardoso, you have a U.S. president who has the gall to impose these kinds of demands on the Brazilian state, on the Brazilian municipality, to say, to take that position in Rio. I think the most concrete issue is this. He's not interested in the Brazilian people. He wants a photograph showing him embracing little black children in a neighborhood that can be described as poor, and that this will be beamed through the media, through public radio, through television, ABC, NBC, of Clinton meets the people. And it's very interesting, Amy, that your account of his meeting in Brazil, in Rio, was not reported as such in public radio. It was reported as Clinton meeting these children in a privately subsidized school. I believe it was by Xerox, and he gave a plug for American volunteerism and charity as the solution to the social problems.
No. Actually, that description was from the New York Times.
Right. Well, the point is that what was intended by that was a projection of the people loving Clinton, loving the free market message. And, of course, that appeared in a story in the New York Times, but there was no follow-up on it. There was no relating those security concerns that the president has with the general free market policy, which has provoked such hostility and such freedom that he has to envelop himself in a military cocoon in order to shake hands with some little children.
I want to end with this question, Professor Petras, about your recent trip to Argentina for a conference honoring Che Guevara.
Yes. I think it was a very interesting meeting because in many ways the young people were there were not the chic poster set that we hear in the media, that young people are superficially interested in the personality, the bearded, handsome figure. These were young people who are activists. They're interested in changing their society. There were close to 2,000 people, I'd say about 50 or 60% were young people. They are hit very badly with the free market policies. They don't trust a lot of the party leaders, many of whom start on the left and finish on the right. And they see Che Guevara as a consequential political figure, who had a forthright position of opposition to U.S. domination of the continent, who was very interested in poor people, was interested in agrarian reform, who saw national and social liberation as very modern, very relevant to the contemporary problems. And I think that's what was outstanding. It wasn't a bunch of old middle-aged leftists reminiscing about the 60s. There wasn't commercial promoters using the Che emblem as a way of making money. On the contrary, a lot of young people came on buses all the way from Brazil, Uruguay, the interior of Argentina, some of them traveling 30 hours. They attended most of the sessions, discussed, were open to new ideas. This wasn't the cult of Che Guevara. They're looking for ideas and a kind of political direction, the way out from this nightmare that's called free market capitalism.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, James Petras. James Petras is professor of Latin American history at the State University of New York at Binghamton. He's just returned from Argentina as we wrap up coverage of President Clinton's trip to Argentina, Venezuela, and Brazil. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Leslie George has been our director. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Tomorrow, tune into Democracy Now! For coverage of the Media and Democracy Congress that took place in New York this past weekend. Thanks for listening.